This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Daniel Deronda by George Eliot. Chapter 32. In all ages it hath been a favorite text that a potent love hath the nature of an isolated vitality, whereto the mind's opinions and wonted resolves are altogether alien. As, for example, Daphnis, his frenzy, wherein it had availed him to have been convinced of Heracles, his doctrine, or the filter-bred passion of Tristan, who, though he had been as deep as Dun Scotus, would have had his reasoning marred by that cup too much. Or Romeo, in his sudden taking for Juliet, wherein any objections he might have held against Ptolemy had made little difference to his discourse under the balcony. Yet all love is not such, even though potent. Nay, this passion hath as large scope as any for allying itself with every operation of the soul, so that it shall acknowledge and affect from the imagined light of unproven firmaments, and have its scale set to the grander orbits of what hath been and shall be. Deronda, on his return to town, could assure Sir Hugo of his having lodged in Grandcourt's mind a distinct understanding that he could get £50,000 by giving up a prospect which was probably distant and not absolutely certain. But he had no further sign of Grandcourt's disposition in the matter than that he was evidently inclined to keep up friendly communications. "And what did you think of the future bride on a nearer survey?" said Sir Hugo. "I thought better of her than I did in Lebrun. Roulette was not a good setting for her. It brought out something of the demon. At Diplo she seemed much more womanly and attractive, less hard and self-possessed. I thought her mouth and eyes had quite a different expression." "Don't flirt with her too much, Dan," said Sir Hugo, meaning to be agreeably playful. "If you make Grandcourt savage when they come to the Abbey at Christmas, it will interfere with my affairs."
"I can stay in town, sir."
"No, no, Lady Mallinger and the children can't do without you at Christmas. Only don't make mischief, unless you can get up a duel, and manage to shoot Grandcourt, which might be worth a little inconvenience."
"I don't think you ever saw me flirt," said Deronda, not amused.
"Oh, haven't I, though," said Sir Hugo provokingly. "You are always looking tenderly at the women, and talking to them in a Jesuitical way. You're a dangerous young fellow, a kind of Lovelace who will make the Clarissas run after you instead of you running after them."
What was the use of being exasperated at a tasteless joke? Only the exasperation comes before the reflection on utility. Few friendly remarks are more annoying than the information that we are always seeming to do what we never mean to do. Sir Hugo's notion of flirting, it was to be hoped, was rather peculiar. For his own part, Deronda was sure that he had never flirted. But he was glad that the baronet had no knowledge about the repurchase of Gwendolen's necklace to feed his taste for this kind of rallying. He would be on his guard in future. For example, in his behavior at Mrs. Merrick's, where he was about to pay his first visit since his arrival from Lebrun. For Mirah was certainly a creature in whom it was difficult not to show a tender kind of interest both by looks and speech. Mrs. Merrick had not failed to send Deronda a report of Mirah's well-being in her family. "We are getting fonder of her every day," she had written. "At breakfast time we all look toward the door with expectation to see her come in, and we watch her and listen to her as if she were a native from a new country. I have not heard a word from her lips that gives me a doubt about her. She is quite contented and full of gratitude. My daughters are learning from her, and they hope to get her other pupils, for she is anxious not to eat the bread of idleness, but to work like my girls. Mab says our life has become like a fairy tale, and all she is afraid of is that Mirah will turn into a nightingale again and fly away from us. Her voice is just perfect, not loud and strong, but searching and melting like the thoughts of what has been. That is the way old people like me feel a beautiful voice." But Mrs. Merrick did not enter into particulars which would have required her to say that Amy and Mab, who had accompanied Mirah to the synagogue, found the Jewish faith less reconcilable with their wishes in her case than that of Scott's Rebecca. They kept silence out of delicacy to Mirah, with whom her religion was too tender a subject to be touched lightly. But after a while Amy, who was much of a practical reformer, could not restrain a question. "Excuse me, Mirah, but does it seem quite right to you that the women should sit behind rails in a gallery apart?" "Yes, I never thought of anything else," said Mirah, with mild surprise. "And you like better to see the men with their hats on," said Mab, cautiously proposing the smallest item of difference. "Oh, yes, I like what I have always seen there, because it brings back to me the same feelings, the feelings I would not part with for anything else in the world." After this, any criticism, whether of doctrine or practice, would have seemed to these generous little people an inhospitable cruelty. Mirah's religion was of one fiber with her affections, and had never presented itself to her as a set of propositions. "She says herself she is a very bad Jewess, and does not half know her people's religion," said Amy, when Mirah was gone to bed. "Perhaps it would gradually melt away from her, and she would pass into Christianity like the rest of the world if she got to love us very much, and never found her mother. It is so strange to be of the Jews' religion now." "Oh, oh, oh!" cried Mab. "I wish I were not such a hideous Christian. How can an ugly Christian who is always dropping her work convert a beautiful Jewess who has not a fault?" "It may be wicked of me," said shrewd Kate, "but I cannot help wishing that her mother may not be found. There might be something unpleasant." "Oh, don't think it, my dear," said Mrs. Meyrick. "I believe Mirah is cut out after the pattern of her mother. And what a joy it would be to her to have such a daughter brought back again. But a mother's feelings are not worth reckoning, I suppose." She shot a mischievous glance at her own daughters. "And a dead mother is worth more than a living one?" "Well, and so she may be, little mother," said Kate, "but we would rather hold you cheaper and have you alive." Not only the Meyricks, whose various knowledge had been acquired by the irregular foraging to which clever girls have usually been reduced, but Deronda himself, with all his masculine instruction, had been roused by this apparition of Mirah to the consciousness of knowing hardly anything about modern Judaism or the inner Jewish history. The chosen people have been commonly treated as a people chosen for the sake of somebody else, and their thinking as something, no matter exactly what, that ought to have been entirely otherwise. And Deronda, like his neighbors, had regarded Judaism as a sort of eccentric fossilized form which an accomplished man might dispense with studying and leave to specialists. But Mirah, with her terrified flight from one parent and her yearning after the other, had flashed on him the hitherto neglected reality that Judaism was something still throbbing in human lives, still making for them the only conceivable vesture of the world. And in the idling excursion on which he immediately afterward set out with Sir Hugo, he began to look for the outsides of synagogues and the title of books about the Jews. This awakening of a new interest, this passing from the supposition that we hold the right opinions on a subject that we are careless about, to a sudden care for it, and a sense that our opinions were ignorance, is an effectual remedy for ennui, which unhappily cannot be secured on a physician's prescription. But Deronda had carried it with him, and endured his weeks of lounging all the better. It was on this journey that he first entered a Jewish synagogue, at Frankfurt, where his party rested on a Friday. In exploring the Judengasse, which he had seen long before, he remembered well enough its picturesque old houses. What his eyes chiefly dwelt on now were the human types there, and his thought, busily connecting them with the past phases of their race, stirred that fiber of historic sympathy which had helped to determine in him certain traits worth mentioning for those who are interested in his future. True, when a young man has a fine person, no eccentricity of manners, the education of a gentleman, and a present income, it is not customary to feel a prying curiosity about his way of thinking or his peculiar tastes. He may very well be settled in life as an agreeable, clever young fellow without passing a special examination on those heads. Later, when he is getting rather slovenly and portly, his peculiarities are more distinctly discerned, and it is taken as a mercy if they are not highly objectionable. But anyone wishing to understand the effect of after events on Deronda should know a little more of what he was at 25 than was evident in ordinary intercourse. It happened that the very vividness of his impressions had often made him the more enigmatic to his friends, and had contributed to an apparent indefiniteness in his sentiments. His early awakened sensibility and reflectiveness had developed into a many-sided sympathy, which threatened to hinder any persistent course of action, As soon as he took up any antagonism, though only in thought, he seemed to himself like the Sabine warriors in the memorable story, with nothing to meet his spear but flesh of his flesh and objects that he loved. His imagination had so wrought itself to the habit of seeing things as they probably appeared to others, that a strong partisanship, unless it were against an immediate oppression, had become an insincerity for him. His plenteous flexible sympathy had ended by falling into one current with that reflective analysis which tends to neutralize sympathy. Few men were able to keep themselves clearer of vices than he. Yet he hated vices mildly, being used to think of them less in the abstract than as a part of mixed human natures having an individual history, which it was the bent of his mind to trace with understanding and pity. With the same innate balance, he was fervidly democratic in his feeling for the multitude, and yet, through his affections and imagination, intensely conservative. Voracious of speculations on government and religion, yet both to part with long-sanctioned forms which for him were quick with memories and sentiments that no argument could lay dead. We fall on the leaning side, and Deronda suspected himself of loving too well the losing causes of the world. Martyrdom changes sides, and he was in danger of changing with it, having a strong repugnance to taking up that clue of success which the order of the world often forces upon us, and makes it treason against the common weal to reject. And yet his fear of falling into an unreasoning, narrow hatred made a check for him. He apologized for the errors of privilege. He shrank with dislike from the loser's bitterness and the denunciatory tone of the unacceptable innovator. A too reflective and diffusive sympathy was in danger of paralyzing in him that indignation against wrong and that selectness of fellowship which are the conditions of moral force. And in the last few years of confirmed manhood he had become so keenly aware of this that what he most longed for was either some external event or some inward light that would urge him into a definite line of action and compress his wandering energy. He was ceasing to care for knowledge. He had no ambition for practice, unless they could both be gathered up into one current with his emotions. And he dreaded, as if it were a dwelling-place of lost souls, that dead anatomy of culture which turns the universe into a mere ceaseless answer to queries, and knows not everything, but everything else about everything, as if one should be ignorant of nothing concerning the scent of violets except the scent itself for which one had no nostril. But how and whence was the needed event to come? The influence that would justify partiality and make him what he longed to be, yet was unable to make himself an organic part of social life instead of roaming in it like a yearning disembodied spirit, stirred with a vague social passion, but without fixed local habitation to render fellowship real? To make a little difference for the better was what he was not contented to live without. But how to make it? It is one thing to see your road, another to cut it. He found some of the fault in his birth and the way he had been brought up, which had laid no special demands on him and had given him no fixed relationship except one of a doubtful kind. But he did not attempt to hide from himself that he had fallen into a meditative numbness and was gliding farther and farther from that life of practically energetic sentiment which he would have proclaimed, if he had been inclined to proclaim anything, to be the best of all life and for himself the only way worth living. He wanted some way of keeping emotion and its progeny of sentiments, which make the savors of life, substantial and strong in the face of a reflectiveness that threatened to nullify all differences. To pound the objects of sentiment into small dust, yet keep sentiment alive and active, was something like the famous recipe for making cannon, to first take a round hole and then enclose it with iron. Whatever you do, keeping fast hold of your round hole. Yet how distinguish what our will may wisely save in its completeness from the heaping of cat mummies and the expensive cult of enshrined putrefactions? Something like this was the common undercurrent in Deronda's mind while he was reading law or imperfectly attending to polite conversation. Meanwhile, he had not set about one function in particular with zeal and steadiness, not an admirable experience to be proposed as an ideal, but a form of struggle before break of day which some young men since the patriarch have had to pass through, with more or less of bruising, if not laming. I have said that under his calm exterior he had a fervor which made him easily feel the presence of poetry in everyday events, and the forms of the Judengasse, rousing the sense of union with what is remote, set him musing on two elements of our historic life which that sense raises into the same region of poetry: the faint beginnings of faiths and institutions, and their obscure lingering decay, the dust and withered remnants with which they are apt to be covered, only enhancing for the awakened perception the impressiveness either of a sublimely penetrating life, as in the twin green leaves that will become the sheltering tree, or of a pathetic inheritance in which all the grandeur and the glory have become a sorrowing memory. This imaginative stirring, as he turned out of the Judengasse and continued to saunter in the warm evening air, meaning to find his way to the synagogue, neutralized the repellent effect of certain ugly little incidents on his way. Turning into an old bookshop to ask the exact time of service at the synagogue, he was affectionately directed by a precocious Jewish youth, who entered cordially into his wanting, not the fine new building of the Reformed, but the old rabbinical school of the Orthodox, and then cheated him like a pure Teuton, only with more amenity, in his charge for a book, quite out of request as one
nicht so leicht zu bekommen.
Meanwhile, at the opposite counter, a deaf and grisly tradesman was casting a flinty look at certain cards, apparently combining advantages of business with religion, and shoutingly proposed to him in a Jew dialect by a dingy man in a tall coat hanging from neck to heel, a bag in hand, and a broad low hat surmounting his chosen nose, who had no sooner disappeared than another dingy man of the same pattern issued from the background glooms of the shop, and also shouted in the same dialect. In fact, Deronda saw various queer-looking Israelites not altogether without guile, and just distinguishable from queer-looking Christians of the same mixed morale. In his anxiety about Mirah's relatives, he had lately been thinking of vulgar Jews with a sort of personal alarm. But a little comparison will often diminish our surprise and disgust at the aberrations of Jews and other dissidents whose lives do not offer a consistent or lovely pattern of their creed. And this evening Deronda, becoming more conscious that he was falling into unfairness and ridiculous exaggeration, began to use that corrective comparison. He paid his taller too much without prejudice to his interest in the Hebrew destiny, or his wish to find the Rabbinische Schule, which he arrived at by sunset, and entered with a good congregation of men. He happened to take his seat in a line with an elderly man from whom he was distant enough to glance at him more than once as rather a noticeable figure, his ample white beard and felt hat framing a profile of that fine contour which may as easily be Italian as Hebrew. He returned Deronda's notice till at last their eyes met, an undesirable chance with unknown persons, and a reason to Deronda for not looking again. But he immediately found an open prayer book pushed toward him and had to bow his thanks. However, the congregation had mustered, the reader had mounted to the Alma Mor or platform, and the service began. Deronda, having looked enough at the German translation of the Hebrew in the book before him to know that he was chiefly hearing psalms and Old Testament passages or phrases, gave himself up to that strongest effect of chanted liturgies which is independent of detailed verbal meaning, like the effect of an Allegri's Miserere or a Palestrina's Magnificat. The most powerful movement of feeling with the liturgy is the prayer which seeks for nothing special, but as a yearning to escape from the limitations of our own weakness and an invocation of all good to enter and abide with us, or else a self-oblivious lifting up of gladness, a gloria in excelsis, that such good exists. Both the yearning and the exaltation gathering their utmost force from the sense of communion in a form which has expressed them both for long generations of struggling fellow men. The Hebrew liturgy, like others, has its transitions of litany, lyric, proclamation, dry statement, and blessing. But this evening all were one for Deronda. The chant of the Chazaris, or reader's grand, wide-ranging voice with its passage from monotony to sudden cries, the outburst of sweet boys' voices from the little choir, the devotional swaying of men's bodies backward and forward, the very commonness of the building and the shabbiness of the scene, where a national faith which had penetrated the thinking of half the world and molded the splendid forms of that world's religion, was finding a remote, obscure echo. All were blent for him as one expression of a binding history, tragic and yet glorious. He wondered at the strength of his own feeling. It seemed beyond the occasion, what one might imagine to be a divine influx in the darkness, before there was any vision to interpret. The whole scene was a coherent strain, its burden a passionate regret, which, if he had known the liturgy for the day of reconciliation, he might have clad in its authentic burden. Happy the eye which saw all these things, but verily to hear only of them afflicts our soul. Happy the eye that saw our temple and the joy of our congregation, but verily to hear only of them afflicts our soul. Happy the eye that saw the fingers when tuning every kind of song, but verily to hear only of them afflicts our soul. But with the cessation of the devotional sounds and the movement of many indifferent faces and vulgar figures before him, there darted into his mind the frigid idea that he had probably been alone in his feeling, and perhaps the only person in the congregation for whom the service was more than a dull routine. There was just time for this chilling thought before he had bowed to his civil neighbor and was moving away with the rest, when he felt a hand on his arm, and turning with the rather unpleasant sensation which this abrupt sort of claim is apt to bring, he saw close to him the white-bearded face of that neighbor, who said to him in German, "Excuse me, young gentleman, allow me. What is your parentage? Your mother's family? Her maiden name?" Deronda had a strongly resistant feeling. He was inclined to shake off hastily the touch on his arm, but he managed to slip it away and said coldly, "I am an Englishman." The questioner looked at him dubiously still for an instant, then just lifted his hat and turned away. Whether under a sense of having made a mistake or of having been repulsed, Deronda was uncertain. In his walk back to the hotel, he tried to still any uneasiness on the subject by reflecting that he could not have acted differently. How could he say that he did not know the name of his mother's family to that total stranger, who indeed had taken an unwarrantable liberty in the abruptness of his question, dictated probably by some fancy of likeness such as often occurs without real significance? The incident, he said to himself, was trivial. But whatever import it might have, his inward shrinking on the occasion was too strong for him to be sorry that he had cut it short. It was a reason, however, for his not mentioning the synagogue to the Mallingers, in addition to his usual inclination to reticence on anything that the baronet would have been likely to call quixotic enthusiasm. Hardly any man could be more good-natured than Sir Hugo. Indeed, in his kindliness, especially to women, he did actions which others would have called romantic, but he never took a romantic view of them, and in general smiled at the introduction of motives on a grand scale, or of reasons that lay very far off. This was the point of strongest difference between him and Deronda, who rarely ate at breakfast without some silent discursive flight after grounds for filling up his day according to the practice of his contemporaries.